June, Year of God, 894. 1. Royal Palace, City of Manchir, Princedom of Coruscant.
So, Corin, what do you think this is all about?
Father, if I knew that, I'd also know how to read minds, predict weather, choose the winning horse, and figure out where my left sock's gone,
Sir Corin Garvey replied, and Earl Anvil Rock laughed.
I think we can probably make at least a few guesses, Rysel,
Sir Tarrell Lecter offered. The Earl of Tartarian sat at one end of the conference table, cleaning his fingernails with the tip of a penknife while he leaned back, comfortably, with the heels of his boots propped on the seat of the chair normally assigned to the Earl of Craggy Hill. Personally, Garvey suspected Tartarian hadn't exactly chosen that particular chair at random.
"Well, in that case, Tarrell, guess away," Anvil Rock invited.
"First," Tartarian said, "Captain Athrawes asked to speak to just the four of us, not to the entire council. Second, we all know how close the Sajan is to the Emperor, and unless I miss my guess, the Empress as well. Third, Archbishop Michael isn't going to be present."
He paused, holding up his left hand to admire his nails, and Anvil Rock snorted.
"And those three considerations suggest exactly what to your powerful intellect?"
"I strongly suspect the good captain is going to deliver a message to us," Tartarian replied, looking across his hand at his old friend. "Given the Archbishop's absence, I would also suspect it's a seriously secular message, possibly the sort of thing the Church doesn't want to know about."
"Why do you think he's waited so long to deliver it in that case?"
"That's a bit harder," Tartarian conceded. "On the other hand, we know they've been receiving a steady stream of messages, so it seems most likely this is something he didn't know about until Caleb sent him a dispatch."
"Except, my lord," Sir Charles Doyle put in respectfully from his place beside Garvey, "that Caleb and Charlian left for Telisburg over a month ago, which means they're at sea right now, which would make sending any dispatches to Sajan Merlin a bit difficult."
"Rash and impetuous youngsters who point out holes in their elders' logic come to bad ends," Tartarian observed, to no one in particular, and Doyle, who wasn't all that many years younger than the Earl, chuckled.
"Still, Tarrell, he has a point," Anvil Rock said.
"Of course he does. If he didn't, I'd simply annihilate him with the deadly force of my own logic and be done with it. As it is, I'm forced to admit I have no idea why the Sajan has waited this long to discuss whatever it is with us. There."
He began working on the nails of his other hand.
"I've admitted it, I'm fallible."
"Be still, my beating heart,"
Anvil Rock said tartly, and it was Garvey's turn to laugh. The truth was that none of them had any idea what Captain Athrawes wanted to speak to them about. Except, of course, that Tartarian was almost certainly correct about who the Sajan would be speaking for. On the other hand, the atmosphere in the council chamber was enormously more relaxed and confident than it had been only a few months ago. Garvey still bitterly regretted Father Timon's murder, yet Wyman's decision to have him killed had clearly been the turning point here in Manchir. Garvey wasn't about to issue any overly optimistic proclamations of triumph, but the incidence of violence had plummeted following Wyman's arrest, and the ex-intendant's execution had evoked not protests and riots, but something much closer to a huge sigh of relief. Anti-Karras broadsides were still being tacked up on doors throughout the city. Temple loyalists continued to gather in their own churches, following their own priests. Parties of Carisian Marines continued to draw glowers, even the occasional catcall. But no one actually threw dead cat lizards any longer. In fact, they didn't even throw overripe tomatoes. The Carisian occupation was still a source of resentment, yet most Coruscantians, in the southeast at least, seemed prepared to accept, if only grudgingly, that the Carisians were doing their best to avoid walking all over them. The fact that Viceroy General Churman had been scrupulous about observing both local law and customary usages wherever possible hadn't hurt. And the fact that the Garizians obviously trusted Garvai's guardsmen to serve as the Princedom's primary peacekeeping force hadn't been lost on Coruscandians either. The acid test, in many ways, had come when three Garizian Marines raped a young farm girl. Garvai had gone straight to Churman, and the Viceroy General's response had been quick and decisive. He'd ordered the suspected rapist's arrest, impaneled a court-martial, and had Garvai's guardsmen bring in the Coruscandian witnesses. The defense counsel's questioning had been sharp, but those witnesses had been given full credence, and the court's verdict had been swift. The Articles of War set only one penalty for forcible rape, and the guilty parties had been marched to the very farm where the crime had taken place for execution. That hadn't been the only incident of swift, impartial justice either. To be fair, there'd been far fewer such incidents than Garvai would have expected. In fact, he was unhappily aware that his own army, when he'd been resisting the Garizian invasion, had committed more crimes against Prince Hector's subjects than the invaders had. There'd been additional infractions, of course. Garizians might be well-behaved, but they were scarcely saints. Theft, looting, the occasional fistfight or beating, and at least two deaths, one of which had clearly been a matter of self-defense on the Garizians' part. Yet the Princedom subjects had been forced, many against their will, to concede that the occupation truly was determined to enforce justice and not just Garizian authority.